Film reviews first this evening. We have Flesh-Eating Zombies and A Space-Obsessed Orphan. In Pixar's latest animated feature, Elio, we meet a little boy who's only dying for aliens to abduct him and show him their magical worlds. But as ever, it's a case to be careful what you wish for. We'll also be talking about the Swedish entry for the Oscars, The Last Journey, about a depressed French teacher who finds the transition to retirement hard to navigate. It's a documentary, I think. This one. And we will. Oh, I should say that Hilary White and Cara O'Doherty are with me in studio, and we're going to start with the big release of the week, 28 years later. Latest installment of director Danny Boyle and writer Alex Garland's Zombie Apocalypse series, which started, of course, with 28 Days Later, which was had our own Cillian Murphy as an actor in it. He has an executive producer credit on 28 Years Later. And in the new film, The Rage Virus has been contained to Britain and Ireland. More of that later. With the uninfected living in a small communities on offshore islands, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Jodie Comer and Ralph Fiennes star in this latest installment. What kind of world do we arrive into in this film? I did say, yeah, Cara O'Doherty and Hilary White. What kind of world do we arrive into when we meet the Jodie Comer, Aaron Taylor-Johnson and young fella Spike family and their neighbours?
It's this bizarre world where people have formed a community. They've lived through horrors and they're now on to the next generation of children who are being raised there. But it has this very strange folk feeling to it. They don't have electricity. They have to forage. And they've kind of returned to this kind of very country style life. But they're also, I mean, they're quite miserable because there's monster things just living across the causeway from them. But it's a really weird world in which children have to be trained how to hunt and kill the baddies, which is fair enough. They're living in a horrible situation.
And the baddies being
the infected. But they, when kids come of age, everybody in the community comes out and bangs drums and wishes them luck as they send them on their way for their first kill. So it's a very far drive.
And that's usually around the age of 15, yeah. They're sent across the causeway. So at low tide, they can walk across. It's a specific part of England, I think, where this actually is the case. You can walk across the causeway, but, you know, you have to get back. Yeah, before the tide rises, obviously.
4-hour window to get across if you do need to go across.
It's like Omi Island in Connemara.
Yeah, a bit of that.
With zombies.
Yeah, there are no zombies on either the island of Omi or on the neighbouring mainland.
Just to clarify,
in case people think
most of the time
suggesting such things. Yeah. So, Spike, amazing, I have to say, the young actor here, what's his name?
Alfie Williams.
Alfie Williams, extraordinary maturity in his performance, I thought. Spike and his daddy, Jamie, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, head off across to the mainland.
It's sort of like a rite of passage. It's like, we're going to take you out, and he's basically going to blood the child. He's going to have his first kill, and he's sort of on this field trip. He's showing him the different type of zombies. There are these very sort of obese ones that crawl along the forest floor. And there are these alphas. These are infected that have evolved slightly more intellectual capacity and super strength as well.
And they work in packs. And if a pack of them comes after you, you're
absolutely
kind of in trouble.
Yeah, for sure.
This is only a teeny little 6-second clip from the moment, or one of the moments when daddy and son are on the mainland and in front of them is a zombie. And here's the instruction that daddy passes on to son.
Infection takes away their minds. It's got no mind, it's got no soul. Kill it.
I have to say, when he says that in the film, and it's a bit longer than that in the actual film itself, he's got no mind, he's got no soul, kill it. You have to think of, well, I had to think of a couple of things. Immigration was one and Brexit was another.
I know, and it is this multi-layered thing, and you can see it from the point of view of this film that if this child doesn't learn how to kill these things, he is not going to survive. He's going to become one of them. And you can 100% understand why his father wants him to be able to do this and not look back. But it is very, very layered, because the thing is, these infected were once human. They're technically still human. They are evolving. As Hilary said, they have somewhat of evil intellect. So they are necessarily something something that have no soul? It's really
that's the judgment of
a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, I was like, "Yep, kill it, kill it," and then I was like, "Oh, I don't know about this. This is
I suppose any zombie film. You know, it's in the 50s, it was about alien race and it was about communism. And now you can put, I suppose, at any moment in society, Hilary, you can place it as whoever that outsider is.
Pretty much. It's always been the genre that has been very effective at really reflecting what's monstrous about human society. In fact, you use these, you know, the undead hordes coming over the hill, and what does that bring out in the human societies that are facing them? And it's got a very rich tradition in that you just alluded to. And here with this, obviously, there are a lot of questions like that are brought up about, you know, what exactly is this child being asked to do? And is this a way forward for humanity that they're just going to sort of perpetuate this idea that these things are just target practice?
Yeah. Now, most of the action is, in fact, you know, the community... kind of they have this medieval feel off them, even though we have some kind of Ladybird book pages up on the wall in the school and things like that. They use bows and arrows. They have no modern warfare elements, have no technologies of any kind in terms of mobile phones or anything like that, or electricity, indeed, Cara. And there's this constant presence of old films of longbowmen firing their arrows in England, one presumes.
So, I mean, for these people, their world stopped in 2002 and everything went backwards. They lost the ability to do anything in any modern ways. So they've had to bring back the old ways. But Danny Boyle has always been an inventive director who likes to do things that bit different. So, yeah, he has overlaid images both from film, from newsreels, of war through the ages. And it's this really interesting look at, when you look at England's, or the UK's history, it's a country that has been, whether the cause or they've been involved in wars continually, and this is another war that they have to fight.
Yeah, and another thing, as well as those images of the longbowmen and I'm presuming they're longbowmen, but you know, bows and arrows at any rate that look as if they're from a Robin Hood film or something, or the equivalent. At one point, we also hear the famous Rudyard Kipling poem, Boots, all about the Boer War, but it could be about any war, I guess. And the actor in the recording here is Taylor Holmes. And this recording, believe it or not, was made about 110 years ago.
7, 6, 11, 5, 9 and 20 miles today, 4, 11, 17, 32 the day before. Boots, boots, boots. Boots moving up and down again. There's no discharge in the war. Don't look at what's in front of you. Boots, 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 boots moving up and down again. Men, 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 men go mad with watching them. There's no discharge in the war. Your eyes drop, they will get the top of you. Boot, 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 moving up and down again. There's no discharge in the war.
And somebody's very frightened at the very end of it there. We can hear the panting and the breathing. It is chilling stuff, that. And again, it's one of the layers that he places in it. Obviously, there's an anti-war message within the film as well. Before we get to the Ralph Fiennes character, did all of these aspects come together for you, Hilary, to give you an idea of what is going on? And it's very clear at the end of this there's a sequel. So I'm wondering whether we've got the full story yet.
I can see what Danny Boyle was doing with them, and certainly when the trailer dropped for this film a number of months ago, I thought that was incredibly intense to have that voiceover,
boots,
recording of the Rudyard Kipling poem. But I thought within the screenplay of the film and the action of this film, I actually found it slightly distracting, and I found it slightly took me out of what the characters were engaged in at the time. And I'd say the same about those clips of, you know, the archers, the Battle of Agincourt, and the yeomanry. I thought you know, you don't really need to be doing this. These are things that you should be able to get in under the radar anyway in a film like this. You don't need to show us actual images spliced into it.
Yeah, I take your point, but I would also argue, perhaps, Cara, that, you know, when I hear zombie film, it kind of, I think, how long am I going to have to sit through this, is often my emotion. But in this particular case, those extra layers to it kind of pulled me out of the zombieism to make me think about other parallels. How did it work for you?
I'm with you on that exactly. I think, yeah, it turns what could be a silly, well, it's Danny Boyle, it's never going to be a silly gurg zombie film, but it takes that element away and it makes it a much bigger thing, and it makes it more profound, and you do start to see the connections between it now, reality and the past. So I think it brings a lot of depth to it.
Yeah, and Ralph Fiennes doesn't appear until the third act of the film, and probably he's a doctor is all I'm going to say, and I think probably in the new installment, which I think is already made and ready to go
in January,
we'll probably find out more about his character then.
Yeah, he's very much the Colonel Kurtz character. He's the character that the two of them, that Alfie and his ill mother Isla, played by Jodie Comer, head off in search of a miracle cure for her. She obviously is ill to some extent, but there's no doctors anymore in this world,
so they don't know,
And so they have to go on this treacherous journey to find him. But I would say in typical Alex Garland fashion, Alex Garland, the screenwriter, there's all these sort of different tangents that they are encouraged to peel off to go in search of jeopardy on the way to find this person, which I didn't think was very in keeping with the world within this film, that the characters would behave like
briefly, this. Briefly, standout performances and stars from you, Hilary, first.
I think the core trio, I think, of Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Jodie Comer and Alfie Williams and Ralph Fiennes, I say as well, are the real standout. The rest of it, I was actually really disappointed by this. I thought the first film was so visceral, so much adrenaline to it. Your knuckles were white, your mouth were dry. It was dry watching this. And with this, I just thought it was very muddled tone. 2.5 stars, I was really let down by this.
And we should say, by the way, the 28 days later, they kind of ignored the 28 weeks later film.
Yeah, it's gone.
Neither Alex Garland nor Danny Boyle were involved in that, so possibly that's why.
Yeah,
does it work overall for you and performances that stood out? That central quartet?
Absolutely. Well, particularly young Alfie.
Oh, I thought he was amazing.
He is remarkable. A child, he's definitely going places. It worked for me. It's intense. Those, I thought there was really tender moments within the darkness. It is a really hard watch, though. It is gruesome, more so than the first film. So it's not for the faint-hearted. But I think if you can stomach it, it's a good watch.
Yeah, it's fairly explicit.
It is nasty.
When the zombies die, by Lord,
and watch
they
out
die.
For the distasteful joke in the final.
Yeah, there's a well-known English figure that I hadn't fully picked up on, but the minute you said it to us, Hilary, I kind of picked up on it then. And we leave that for people to see. Yeah. When they go. Let us move on then. Difference of opinion. 2.5 and 4, was that it? Yeah? Right, okay. Let's move on to Elio. New release from Pixar. Always a promising proposition, I think it's safe to say. Monster hit last summer with Inside Out 2. Elio, space-obsessed boy. Tell us about him, Hilary.
An 11-year-old orphan. I mean, we're into kind of a Latino ET setup here with this film. An 11-year-old orphan. He is, his guardian is his Aunt Olga, voiced by Zoe Saldana. She works at a local Air Force base. When he's very young, he has this feeling of not really belonging, not really fitting in the world. And to get around this, he builds up a sort of a homemade apparatus to send a signal out to the cosmos, advertising himself as a perfect candidate for a good old alien abduction. And that's our jumping off point.
That's what he's looking for. Here's a little scene where his aunt, the Zoe Saldana character, as you say, is driving to work. She's his Aunt Olga. And Jonas Kibriab is Elio here and basically annoying her as they drive along.
Look at me in the eye and for once tell me the truth.
Shmeepa de Goomeeba.
No, I'm not learning Elio-ese.
Bufifo Muchango Goomy Shazzle!
Major Solis?
You going to the seminar tonight? There'll be a speaker from the astronaut selection program.
No. No, no, something came up.
Oh, is this the nephew we've heard so much about?
Yes, that's him.
Gluto!
Stop it. I don't know if this is boundary testing or sleep regression or... Which one of these is you?
I don't know, but I think that one is you.
Okay, I've got one last meeting, so I need you to sit here and not move or speak or injure yourself for 10 minutes. I have enough to deal with already.
I don't think he's going to sit there and do nothing for 10 minutes. That is Jonas Kibriab as Elio, and his Aunt Olga, played by Zoe Saldana from the film Elio, the Pixar film. Even as Jonas Kibriab starts to speak, I haven't seen this, but I thought, how cute does he look? Does he look as cute as he sounds?
He is absolutely adorable. Mm. I mean, this is a...
The animated version of him, obviously.
Oh, he is absolutely adorable. And he has that look, you know, butter wouldn't melt, but yeah. But he certainly gets himself into some trouble.
Well, he manages to get himself abducted and he becomes, I hope, spoiler alert, I hope I'm not giving anything away to say, he becomes an intergalactic space ambassador.
Well, no, see, this is the thing. He has to be to audition for the role.
Oh, right,
yeah. They assume he's Earth's leader because why else would he be sending these messages out? And he doesn't enlighten them. So he's given this task. He has to prove that he is worthy to become this international
ambassador. And he has to get a couple of baddies along the way
to
do that.
He has to negotiate with a warmonger, but the warmonger happens to have the most adorable alien son called Glordon, who is essentially a sort of slug type thing. Yeah. And he is so, I want a Glordon. I need one in my life.
Glordon is
Glordon, and he's
somehow managed to make a maggot cute.
He's just adorable, and he wants peace. He doesn't want to grow up and be a warrior and a warlord like his
dad. Lord Grigan, is it?
Lord Grigan. So it's this lovely thing of how two kids together are hoping to change literally their worlds and the universe, and whether they can manage to do
it. And very soon he's caused a diplomatic incident.
I'm sold already. I presume this is cute as Tuppence, and it will be a real summer fair for all the family, Hilary. Am I right, or maybe I'm wrong?
No, I mean it is. I mean, one of the things that was always great about Pixar is that they'd often freight a lot of sort of adult humour and adult sensibilities through under the radar. And there isn't so much of that here, but it's actually quite appropriate because it's really aimed at slightly younger viewers.
Yeah.
The facial expressions are wonderful. The elasticated action is fantastic, and it looks great. All the characters, the aliens, the variety that they have are incredible.
Fabulous. Yeah.
Stars from you on this one, Cara.
A solid 4 stars. It's absolutely gorgeous.
So 3.5 from us.
3.5, but it's one for all the family and younger children in particular.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah.
By younger, do we mean what, under 8 type of thing? 9?
I'd say from 7. We brought a 7-year-old, so he had a great time.
Right. That is Elio, the latest from Pixar. Let us move on then to The Last Journey. This is a Swedish film. It's their entry for the Oscars. We need to know who Philip Hammar are and Fredrik Vikingsson. Anton Deck.
Basically,
Philip and Frederick.
They started out as serious journalists, moved throughout their career into broadcasting.
Anton Deck didn't quite do that.
Became Anton Deck. They're just a little bit older than actual Anton Deck, but that's basically who they are now.
Two pals,
best friends. And when one of them, Philip's dad, Lars, isn't too well, and Philip ropes Frederick into a madcap scheme to bring his spark back.
This is a documentary, and I wasn't sure initially. I mean, I suppose people in Sweden, the minute they see these two guys, they know who they are, and then they're seeing their Philip. Is it Philip's? Philip's elderly father. He's 80, I think.
Lars.
They're seeing his elderly father, and it's very hard not to kind of want to go over and hold him and give Lars a big hug and look after him.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, it's definitely, it's a different style of documentary, this. It's very editorialised, very scripted, very choreographed. But you're sort of won over just because he's so frail, this poor old fellow Lars, who's retired after 40 years of teaching French. And he's a Francophile. He's obsessed with...
And we see images of his final day at school, you know, old family videos.
Yeah, and it's really been very much part of his life. And like a lot of people when they retire, it's how do they define themselves afterwards? And you kind of lose the spark. And it's a very touching idea that they bring him on this road trip down into, you know, deepest, darkest south of France, you know, to the...
In a Renault 4.
An orange Renault 4. Was the family wagon back in the day, you know, and you know, they get into all sorts of things. The father has this sort of romantic idea about very haughty French people having, you know, squabbling in the street and stuff like that. So they hire these two actors to stage this this sort of, you know, road squabble right in front of the cafe, and a lot of stuff is great fun. Admittedly, it really is.
And his wife, Lars's wife Tina, obviously Philip's mother, who seems, I presume, is in and around the same age as Lars, but is like a as bright as buttons and full of life, full of zest. She seems as if she's about 64.
I know, they're so different. And the thing is about with Lars, they sent him for tests. They want to see to find out if there's an underlying issue, to find out if there's something that's making him sort of frail and ill. And they're kind of hoping they'll find something. But it, in a way, he has just lost a lot of his zest, and that's led to all these other physical problems. And it's lovely at some moment when his wife was saying, you know, you are depressed. And he's like, no, I'm just a bit blue. And it's sort of those connections are kicking in there. So she wants this retirement age together. She wants to do things, and he's just not able. So, yeah, Philip comes up with this harebrained way to try and bring back
and he brings his friend with him. I have to say, you'd want to be made of stone when they get the Jack Brel singer to come in the song about long love, and the two, the mummy and the daddy, are sitting there. Oh, and it's just they're in floods listening to the song because it seems to refer directly to their long lasting love.
Yeah, I thought in parts it really pushes those buttons very well, this film. And
you feel manipulated?
I did slightly, just a tiny little bit. I just thought, you know, this is very staged, this entire thing, and it's and maybe it's because I'm not familiar with these two presenters, but I it's a very nice formula, that sort of Goodbye Lenin thing where you have a younger generation going out their way to make an elderly person happy, and you know, really there's no harm in that whatsoever.
There is a feel good feel off it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Did it work overall in stars from you, Henry?
I think it did. I thought it laid it on a little bit thick in places, but 3.5 out of 5 from me.
3.5 out of 5. Cara?
Oh, I just melted when I watched it, and I think sometimes they go a little bit too far, but it's never done out of malice. They just want him to feel better and it's just these kind of questionable misguided attempts to do so. Yeah. It was gorgeous. 4 stars. And if you don't cry when you watch this, there's something.
Yeah, well, there's certainly sections of it, but some of the bits in the car between the two boys are very staged and seem very scripted. Between the two of them, not between the parents. The parents are not acting.
Sure.
Hilary White and Carol Doherty with me this evening, speaking about our three films 28 years later. By the way, I hope to be speaking with Danny Boyle tomorrow and to be broadcasting that on tomorrow night's programme, so looking forward to that. And Elio is the Pixar film we were speaking about, and The Last Journey, the documentary, the Swedish documentary. When Wendy Erskine's first short story collection, Sweet Home, came out in 2018, it announced the arrival of a distinctive new voice. Here was a refreshing, often funny take on contemporary Belfast from an author who combined a keen ear for dialogue with shrewd character observations. So the news that Erskine was writing a debut novel makes The Benefactors one of the most highly anticipated books of 2025. It's the story of Misty, young working class woman assaulted by 3 middle class teenagers. The mothers of these young men band together to defend them, but Misty has considerable allies of her own, not least in, I'd say, streetwise Nan. She's crafty for sure, but she's more streetwise and clever than lots of the others in the book. Mary McGill has been reading The Benefactors for us. She joins me now. I guess these three women, if you describe the three mothers, first of all, Mary, because one of the things that struck me was in normal circumstances, these three women would probably never come across each other's radar because they're from totally different parts of society and parts of the city and communities.
Yes, I suppose the one thing that unifies them, Sean, is that they are middle class, middle class by birth in some instances, and also middle class by sheer endeavour in others. And on that point, I'll go first to Frankie. Frankie grew up in care. She had a very, very difficult background. And by dint of sheer determination and her good looks, she has managed to ascend to the middle class. And she's married now to Neil. She's stepmother to Chris, who was one of the boys concerned in this assault. And she has in some respects left that difficult childhood behind her, but in other respects she is forced to contend with that legacy. So she has to present herself as this very together, very groomed, very adult stepmother type figure. Yeah. Even as Erskine draws out so beautifully throughout the plot, Frankie's past is very much present, and it's that lens through which she interprets much of what unfolds in the novel.
Yeah.
Then we have Miriam, who is a middle class mother, but she is reeling from the sudden and ambiguous death of her husband, Khalil, and And this death, the death itself is a shock, but the circumstances in which it took place have also led her to question their relationship and the supposedly very lovely life that they had been living. And so she is contending with that when this accusation lands on her lap.
And her son's a very quiet young fella. Rami, very quiet young fella.
Very quiet young fella. You could get a real sense of Miriam's shock, and you get a real sense that even Rami himself, he's involved. He's certainly mixed up in this, and it's a horrible, you know, state of affairs altogether. But you certainly get a sense that this is not in keeping with who he understood himself to be, or who those around him understood him to be. So this is very, very shocking for that particular family.
And the final of the three mothers is a woman. At the final of the three mothers is a woman called Brona, who's the CEO of a children's services charity. And CEO, I suppose those are the three letters that kind of define her, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a kind of a contradiction in terms, right? And Rona is, I mean, she is a very recognisable type, I think, in the contemporary climate. She's very concerned with doing good, and to a certain extent, her heart is in the right place. But she's also very concerned with being seen.
Yeah. Oh, have we lost Mary there?
To help young people, but also to rub shoulders with the great and the good in the world of celebrity. So these are three very interesting, very different women in their own rights, but they are all flung together by this assault.
This sexual assault on a young woman called Misty Johnson. And even that name says something to me at any rate. But The Benefactors, the title of the novel, perhaps says even more.
Yes. So Misty, all the young men concerned, as you said, are middle class. Misty is very much working class. She has been raised by effectively a single father, Boogie, who is not her natural dad, but took Misty and his natural daughter, her sister Genevieve, on when they were effectively abandoned as little children. And Boogie's a fascinating character. He has really, you know, he really grew into that role of dad, ably supported by his formidable mother, Nandi, who we will talk about, I'm sure, a little bit later on. But Misty is, you know, the boys are all on the kind of college route, but Misty is working. She's working in a hotel. She's also working on this site called The Benefactors, which is kind of a OnlyFans type situation. So that's how she makes her money on the side. She would love to be, aspires to be a special effects makeup artist. And so she has had her eye on Chris for some time. They get together at a party in an Airbnb.
Another,
and things go very badly wrong.
Yeah, Chris is Frankie. Just to explain it, Chris is the son of Frankie, who's the glamorous woman who came from the difficult background, but now has married into money. You know, as you describe the characters there, it would be very easy to judge every single one of them in some way, both sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. But judgment would be easy to box them off into a little spot. But I'm guessing Wendy Erskine, unless she's changed her writing style, makes us see every person's point of view in this story.
Yes, what Wendy Erskine does that is so striking is that she creates such a past and also an inner life for every single one of her characters. So whatever archetype they are seen to embody outwardly and even on the page, they are all invested, and she takes real time in doing this, really gives us time and space to drill down into who these characters are. And I suppose maybe, you know, for some readers who are very interested in the plot aspect of the story, which is absolutely compelling, what are these women going to do? Is Misty going to get justice and so on and so forth? The kind of the level of kind of back story and exposition with the characters, they may feel a bit frustrated with that. But if you are there to understand why these characters are reacting the way they're reacting, you get such an in-depth idea of that. You know, these individual responses to this singular event, really, really richly drawn by Erskine. And you get a real sense of, oh my God, just the depth of human suffering, yes, but also the human, you know, the human capacity to, you know, deal with these things, survive them, the different attitudes to a singular event like this and what it can mean in the context of somebody's life, what justice looks like to different people. So there's a real kind of, you know, there's a real depth to every single character in this book.
Regarding the plot aspect and that, the sexual assault, how does Wendy Erskine handle that side of it, that side of the story, that part?
Well, I think she... I think she has a real sense of how we would like narratives like this to go. So earlier I mentioned the formidable Nan D, who really comes in to look after Misty when she finds herself in this situation. And what Misty does is she goes to the police. Now, Nan D, and she reports what's happened to her. Now, Nan D has a very different approach to the wrong that has occurred to Misty. She talks about how if this was a film, Misty as a working class girl will be teamed up with some whippersnapper up-and-coming lawyer who is going to work day and night to best the system that is stacked against them, and together they would triumph and everybody would clap and it would be fantastic. But Nan D knows that that is not what the justice system is like. This is her sense of it, and she thinks that for Misty to get what she deserves, as she sees it, she needs to choose an alternative route to justice, as it were. So Nan D has, I suppose, a deep understanding of the class dynamics that are at play and how these manifest in systems like the justice system, for example, particularly around issues like sexual assault.
So we have the three mothers, we have Misty, and then I suppose Nan D really as her major kind of force behind her. Mm. But we also get a set of other voices. We don't need to go into the specifics of any of them because it would just come be too confusing. But it's other perspectives on what has happened, or maybe perspectives on what has happened to these other characters that feed into the story that we're being told.
Yes, there's over. I was just reading before I came on air reports from Hodder and Staunton, who are publishing the book, and they apparently have gathered their largest ever cast for the Benefactors audiobook. And that is because you're talking about 50 plus voices here. Mm. And that is because peppered throughout, you know, the main narrative are all of these named and unnamed kind of comments or asides or monologues. I found they almost worked as pieces of flash fiction. Very often they're like, even if it's only a couple of lines, it's like a whole story within itself. But all of them are either directly or tangentially commenting on the main narrative. And so you really get this sense of how, in a city like Belfast, for example, how a story like this travels, the different positions that people take, the way they make sense of it. They might be directly related to what's happening, or they might have heard about it through the grapevine. It's become strangely distorted. But you, at all, you know, all of these moments that are peppered throughout this polyphonic storytelling, you're getting that kind of like kaleidoscopic effect on the narrative, the way this type of story becomes part of the fabric of a community and the way people talk about it and express themselves through
it. And I'm guessing that part of that aspect of things is once you've made up your mind one way, you get another set of opinions that makes you change your mind.
Yes.
Oh, well, I didn't think of that aspect of things. I mentioned earlier on Wendy Erskine's ear for dialogue. I mean, she has a phenomenal ear, certainly for the Belfast sound. Is that present in the book? I'm guessing and hoping so.
Oh, massively, Sean. If Wendy Erskine decides to do The Life and Times of Nan D, I will absolutely be here for it. And I think I'm very interested to hear what the audiobook is going to sound like with all of these different actors doing all of these different voices. 100%. This is, I should say, a very funny novel as well. Great turns of phrase, great dark humour, even in the most difficult of circumstances. And I think one thing that Erskine does really well with her language, it's kind of, you know, kind of show a character will be doing one thing, but their language will give them away. And, you know, we see ourselves in that continuously. Again, this like deep humanity that comes through in the humour as well.
Sounds as if fans of our short stories will be running out to get the novel. Does it have wider appeal? Will this bring new readership to Wendy Erskine? Are you recommending it, Mary?
I definitely think there'll be more people introduced to Wendy's work on the back of this, and that's an absolutely great thing. I think maybe people who pick it up expecting it to be a plot, like a solely plot-driven narrative, might be slightly put off by the polyphonic style of storytelling. But I think her new fans and her existing fans of her short literature will be very, very happy with this novel.
Nice. Mary McGill telling us about The Benefactors by Wendy Erskine, which is published by Sceptre. The Dreaming Road traces the artistic journey of one of our country's most important and loved artists, Jack Butler Yeats, capturing the many fascinating stages of his life and work. The exhibition is currently showing at the Model in Sligo. Art historian and tour guide extraordinaire Jess Fahey is fresh from giving one of her guided tours of the exhibition. She joins me now from what I believe is a very sunny Sligo town on this Thursday evening. So lucky you for being up in the northwest for that, Jess.
Oh, it's stunning. Absolutely stunning. Ben Bulbin's never looked better.
Yeah. And it looks best at the best. It looks brilliant at the best of times, even in the rain.
That's true.
The Dreaming Road, I suppose dreaming is one part of that title and road is another part of that title. It gives us, I think, a sense of what this exhibition is trying to tell us about Jack B. Yeats.
It does. And it's a very interestingly curated exhibition that isn't just purely chronological. So it is sort of dipping in and out of different themes, I suppose, that you could follow through both in relation to subject matter or his life, as you rightly say. But you do get a sense of there still being this extraordinary progress in relation to how he develops as an artist stylistically. And you get to see that all in the space of this, you know, one exhibition space, which has, as everyone knows, the Nylands is such an extraordinary collection of Jack B. Yeats' works. And then the Dreaming, of course, is what we associate perhaps a little bit more with his later career, much more mystical and mythical and thinking back and memory. And it's sort of a combination of two things I think we can easily find in this exhibition and so clearly associate with him.
I guess we could look at his career in three phases. And if we start at the beginning, it's usually the easiest place to start. I'm just looking at a couple of illustrations in front of me on the computer screen here. The crest of the hill, very straightforward figurative piece, a watercolour from 1904, and indeed an Island Man from 1906, a little bit later. Again, pen and ink and a watercolour, just an a guy standing on a cliff, and all linked in, I'm guessing, with Yeats's interest in J.M. Singh, and giving us an illustrated version, if you like, of what Singh was giving us in terms of writing.
So the Crest of the Hill is 1904, which is just sort of a little bit earlier in relation to Singh, but it has some of those very same ideas. And as you say, he went with Singh into the west of Ireland, originally working for a sort of illustrative piece with the writing, of course, by Singh about the west of Ireland for Manchester Guardian. So those sort of adventures in a way helped him find that kind of visual language of the west of Ireland. But what I find interesting about that work, for example, and it's one of the ones in the exhibition, The Crest of the Hill, is it does something that you find in other examples of work in this time for him, which is by lowering the horizon line, he creates this sort of monumental scale and status of the Irish figure. And in this case, we're guessing some sort of mid-range sort of farmer with a relatively good horse, and he stopped for a moment to smoke a pipe. But he is, you know, king of all he surveys.
Yeah,
and it's very different to the typical image of the west of Ireland that would have existed in the 19th century. It's an interesting kind of re-heroicizing of the west.
No sign of poverty in this, as you say, a kind of middle range, you would guess, farmer up on his horse. And I guess that reflects in many ways the fact that Jack B. Yeats, more of a businessman than his father, for sure. Because Jack B. Yeats, first thing he said, I'm going to be an illustrator, get some money, buy a house and be comfortable, and then I can do my art after that.
Yeah, it seems to come about from love. It's a little romantic. So apparently John Butler Yeats sort of said that he didn't know what Jack got from art school other than he found this lovely lady who, of course, is Cotty, that would go on to be his wife. And according to John, for 3 years from the time that Jack met Cotty, he put his head down, just made all of these pen and ink drawings that he could easily sell to journals and magazines to make some money. Whereas his father very notoriously started as a, you know, theology student, then became a lawyer, and then ultimately gave all of that up to become an artist, but without much success financially, and often believing more in the sort of idea that in order to make a good portrait, you have to get to know the person very well. But it seems he spent more time getting to know the person than ever painting them, and didn't finish, you know, big commissions for Hugh Lane and things like that.
100 portraits or something like that over, I don't know how long, a 50-year period, about two a year.
Years.
Yeah, you know, whereas Jack B. Yeats, like 1,200 paintings, and the majority of them, in fact, in the latter stages of his career.
Yeah, an extraordinary number. It's 56% is of his paintings, which would be around 670 or so, are in the last 15 years of his life.
Wow.
And in 1 year in his late 70s, he painted 80. Yeah, so he outdid his father.
In 1 year, I mean, that's more than a painting a week, which is extraordinary, kind of, when you think about it. Do the family, by the way, figure in many of the pieces that you see in the exhibition? Because quite obviously, the father, John Butler Yeats, an artist himself, the brother, William Butler Yeats, and the two sisters, very active in terms of artistic endeavours.
They're always, it seems like that, interested in depicting each other, particularly John Butler Yeats. And there are three works by him in the exhibition. One, a self-portrait, one, a painting of his son, William Butler Yeats, and then another of Jack Yeats as a child. In relation to Jack's work, which is the majority of the exhibition, there do seem to occasionally be figures that people identify, and particularly Hilary Pyle has been great for these sort of identifications of a possible self-portrait, although it's not necessarily as obvious.
Yeah.
But usually it's a giveaway, you know, brown hat, a little bit like kind of almost like a broad brim sort of cowboy hat. And there's one or two examples that do seem to be, you know, deliberately him, like the Sea in the Lighthouse from 1947, which is a very moving, kind of darker one of his images in the year that his wife actually died. And less so of the other family members in this particular exhibition, but they do come up in certainly his sketchbook, which, and many sketchbooks that he made over the years. But it's the father more so that would give the individual portraits.
We mentioned this idea that, you know, very much the illustrations and the straightforward watercolors or pen and ink drawings are from the early stages. In the middle stage, I suppose we're at the height of the War of Independence that just happened, and the Civil War is in here as well, when he's painting in the 1920s. And I'm looking at Communicating with Prisoners, which I think is part of the exhibition. Very famous painting, this obvious one, obviously, of a group of women looking up as who is it that's in the jail, in Kilmainham jail, in this particular case? Do we know?
We don't know for sure, but we know around the time people like Grace Gifford were in there, as she famously, I know, wrote to William Orpin asking for roller skates and sweets, keeping her sense of humour very much alive while she was in there. So we don't know exactly. He rarely gave that much detail himself about his artworks and, you know, specified, you know, individuals. And again, it has been suggested that it could even be taken from a photograph.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating when you look at that work in person is that he's clearly made artistic decisions and exaggerated the height of the tower. So they're almost kind of like Rapunzel figures, you know, just this tiny little row of windows at the very, very top, and they seem miles away from the women who are not incarcerated, who are down on the ground next to billboards of ads. And it's one of those things that, you know, sparked in me a memory of, you know, reading about some of the women's, you know, Republican or Nationalist magazines and newspapers at the time. And one of them was described as being half chiffon and half guns. And when you look at a painting like this, you're sort of seeing those two worlds so clearly clashing.
The other,
you know, that their friends are coming along in their fashions and they're shouting down, asking for, you know, basic things to help them survive in jail.
The other thing that strikes me in that painting is whereas the illustrations from the earlier part are that, you know, that there's very little in terms of brushwork. We're talking about watercolors and pen and ink anyway, but here you begin to see that he's beginning to manipulate the paint in a much looser type of, in a looser type of way, and even looser again when it comes to the funeral of Harry Boland, which is I think the same year, 1922, as the Communicating with the Prisoner, and the funeral of Harry Boland. Figures gathered around the grave, the blue of the grave, whatever cloth is over the grave, very much that Jack B. Yeats blue that we associate with him. Now, maybe there's a reason why all the faces are kind of covered here and not visible, well, not so that they can't be identified.
They weren't allowed to bring cameras in, so he was the only person really getting to be an eyewitness. Cameras were stopped at the gates because, of course, this being a funeral of an anti-treaty man, it meant that everyone actually at the gravesite could be in danger of you know, being arrested or worse in that very moment. But you're right in terms of the change in style that is in this exhibition so fantastic to witness. You can literally look across the room from, you know, one painting from the 1920s 1920s and then one from the 1940s, and then the ones in between help you see how that became increasingly expressive, increasingly less naturalistic use of color, maybe more expressionistic or kind of emotional use of color, and that this this one artist managed to do all of this, and the change really can be quite striking when you see it. And those ones that you're talking about in the 20s are very much mid period, where you're right in saying that they start to change, but it's not quite all the way.
Whereas the one you spoke about earlier on, The Sea and the Lighthouse, all of these ghostly figures, the vibrant yellow, there are often horses or hounds in these pictures as well. You have to look in these paintings, you have to look carefully to find them. And all of these drawn from memory. Is there much from that late period which I think most people will probably find the most interesting set of works?
Yes, there's a good six, I think, from the later period. But I think having them contrasted, as I say, with some of the earlier ones does help as well, I think, in, seeing the same theme come back again. So it helps you understand the way that he could choose a subject from life in his sort of reportage earlier days of, sketching real life as it happened in front of him, whether it's at a funeral or whatever it may be, to then later in life, not going outside at all or needing to, and just looking inwardly and what would come out with those same thoughts. And there's, some where the figures are kind of like ghost-like within it, or you can get, it really starts to make you ask questions about how we remember, how we think, and what impact that has. And there's a sort of wistful feeling often in them as a consequence of that the style enables. So these two things feed into each other really interestingly.
We should mention before we finish up on it, Nora Nyland, of course, the Sligo County Librarian, who's responsible for this collection in the model. I mean, it's an extraordinary collection. Isn't there? There is a painting from Jack B. Yeats that he gifted to her leaving the Far Point. Is that from the later period as well?
It is indeed. So that's actually from the year his wife died, 1947, and he gifted it to her just 2 months before she died. So when Nyland came in as the Sligo County Librarian, she was really interested in the Yeats family and was determined, to have this room dedicated to them. And she helped, set up the Yeats Society in Sligo, as well as summer schools and things. So she, I think, was, based on most of what I've been reading, was someone who just was determined. She wasn't afraid to ask for what she wanted. And donated works, gifted works, some 300. But it's very rare for a collection to be called after somebody who was, the certainly the impetus behind it, but not the money behind it as such. So it's a great honour for, a woman civil servant of this era to have a collection named after.
And a recognition of the work that she did. Clearly you're having a good time up there, and you're recommending this exhibition if people are travelling that way during the summer, I'm guessing, Jess?
Oh, absolutely. And there's so much more up in Sligo as well. But the model has constant contemporary exhibitions as well. So you get to have
a bit of reliable
Jack B. Yeats and something new too.
All right. Off you go now. Enjoy the rest of the sunny evening in the Northwest. That's Jess Fahey speaking to us from Sligo this evening. Jess's lectures and guided tours, home and abroad. You'll find out more details on her own website, jessicafaheyarthistorian.com. The Dreaming Road, the exhibition we've been speaking about at the Model Arts Centre in Sligo, featuring the works of Jack Butler Yeats, continues until the 1st of November, and in-depth curators tours will run on each Saturday at 11 a.m. throughout June, July and August. The model.ie if you're lucky enough to be in the Northwest at any point over the summer period.